طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with a portion of an interview with the Electronic Intifada's founder, Ali Abu Nima, which was conducted on Al Jazeera English on December 26th of this past year. It concerns Abu Nima's response to the UN Security Council's resolution condemning the continuing illegal development of settlements on occupied Palestinian land. You will remember that the United States unexpectedly abstained on the vote, much to the consternation of Netanyahu. Here is Ali Abu Nima's response to that vote.
Israeli government is claiming the UN vote was the result of a plot masterminded by the Obama administration. They say they'll hand over the proof to Donald Trump when he takes office and leave it up to him whether to share it with the public. The U.S. abstained from the vote, and the White House is denying any involvement in the drafting or wording of the resolution. Israel has also suspended working relations with the 12 countries that voted in favor of the resolution. That will mean much more limited diplomatic contact in the future. Ali Abu Nima is director of the Electronic Intifada and the author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. He joins me via Skype from Chicago, and we appreciate your time. So the response, the fallout from Israel has been swift. It has been harsh, and they're indicating that it's not about to end anytime soon. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's ridiculous for this tiny little country that is really rather insignificant and depends on the charity, the diplomatic, economic, and military charity of the United States for its existence and for its occupation, to essentially be threatening sanctions against the likes of China and France and Ukraine and other countries. And really, this lashing out shows both the isolation of Israel in the world, the growing isolation because of its insistence on continuing to occupy and colonize Palestinian land. And I think it also shows how used Israel has become to enjoying total impunity. So this resolution came as a shock to Israel because Israel got so used to being indulged and coddled by all of these countries for much too long.
This vote so far seems largely symbolic, with the exception of the real actions that Israel is taking. But what practical effect or impact is this going to have on the life of daily Palestinians?
You're right. This resolution is words on paper unless there are real actions put behind it. The resolution itself doesn't threaten any specific sanctions against Israel. And in fact, all of these countries, or most of them anyway, particularly the European countries and the U.S., have said they oppose taking any action against Israel. Let's remember that the Obama administration, which is being castigated and spat at by Israel, just a few months ago signed the biggest military aid package from any one country to another in the history of humanity, which was $38 billion of unconditional military aid to Israel over the next decade. And what I think Israel fears is that this resolution will give impetus to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, which is growing in effect and growing in popularity around the world. And that will eventually put pressure on governments like France and the UK that have been so complicit in Israel's occupation. It will increase the public pressure on them to really start ramping up sanctions against Israel.
What do you expect will happen under a new Donald Trump administration come January 20th?
If his appointment of these extremists like David Friedman as ambassador to Israel is an indication, then we can expect Trump to build on Barack Obama's considerable pro-Israel record and really put the United States in a camp of one. I think what the Security Council vote showed is that the world understands that Israel's actions, its occupation, its violations of Palestinian rights are not tenable, are destabilizing not just the region, but causing instability across the world. And I think the dilemma for Israel is that Israel is wholly dependent on the United States. And what we're seeing in the United States is a fracturing of the traditional bipartisan pro-Israel consensus. I think that this resolution and really what's been happening over the past couple of years in the U.S. has turned support for Israel into a bipartisan issue and increasingly into a niche concern of the American far right, particularly the political Christianist far right in the United States, who are even more pro-Israel than many American Jews. So I think on the whole, Israel is worried because the long run, the story is a weakening of support for Israel in the United States, even though Trump will be more pro-Israel in the short run, okay, and the increasing isolation of Israel globally.
Mr. Ali Abu Nima, Director of the Electronic Intifada, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Ali Abu Nima speaking on Al Jazeera English concerning the UN vote condemning the continuing Israeli development of settlements on occupied Palestinian land. This week in Mondo Weiss, Philip Weiss wrote a very interesting article concerning the double standard applied by many Jewish organizations when it comes to dealing with the refugees flooding out of the Middle East compared to Israel's handling of the Palestinian refugee crisis. He writes, "Over the past few days, a great number of Jewish groups have taken righteous stances against Donald Trump's executive order borrowing immigration from seven mostly Muslim nations and halting the refugee program. But when it comes to Israel, these same groups support the rejection of Palestinian refugees' demands because they would threaten the Jewish nature of the state. The contradiction highlights an uncomfortable truth. The degree to which discriminatory policies of the Jewish state are actually congruent with Trump's American nationalism. The liberal Zionist group J Street is circulating a petition against Trump titled Stand Up for Refugees, Fight for America's Moral Standing in the World, Keep This Nation Open to Refugees. J Street has heightened the plight of Syrian refugees. But when it comes to the Palestinian demand for the return of the 750,000 refugees created by the establishment of Israel in 1948, or their descendants, J Street sounds a lot like the American nationalist Steve Bannon, who was at Trump's elbow. J Street asks and answers the following. Palestinians are constantly invoking the right of return, which would flood Israel with refugees and undermine its homeland for the Jewish people. How can we reach a peace agreement when they continue to make that demand? No two-state agreement will include the full return of Palestinian refugees into Israel. Instead, the issue will be resolved by steps outlined in past peace proposals, which have offered Palestinian refugees citizenship in a future state of Palestine. Former negotiators believe it is most likely that Israel will offer monetary compensation and the symbolic acceptance of some refugees into Israel. Americans for Peace Now has also urged resistance against Trump's refugee order, but it too has been dismissive of Palestinian refugee claims inside Israel, saying that this would end the Jewish state. Demands that the principle of refugees' return be implemented inside Israel are tantamount to a demand that Israel cease to exist as a Jewish state. A solution will have to respect both the sensitivities of the Palestinian refugees and Israel's sovereign right to determine who may live within its borders. This is the right approach, and it is guided by moral, political, and strategic concerns. This week, 18 Jewish institutions and groups in Boston came out with a very strong statement against the Trump order. "We reject any effort to shut our nation's doors on the most vulnerable," they wrote. "We must not close our doors." In response to the executive orders this past week on immigration and separately regarding refugees, we, the undersigned Boston Jewish organizations, philanthropic, civic, and human service organizations, come together to say that these actions, which are causing anxiety, pain, and anguish throughout the immigrant communities and our nation, are unjust. We stand together on the side of empathy and religious tolerance, and we urge the administration to open the gates of compassion to those seeking safety, regardless of their faith or country of origin. But virtually every member of that coalition that is concerned about religious tolerance takes a hard stance against Palestinian refugees because they would threaten the Jewishness of Israel. Many of these groups even deny the existence of the Nakba, or Palestinian catastrophe, Israel's expulsion of Palestinians to make way for a majority Jewish state. Here, for instance, is the Jewish Community Relations Council's hard-hearted position. "Israel didn't expel the refugees. They fled. We're not responsible for their suffering, let alone their property." Israel is not responsible for the creation of the refugee problem or for perpetuating it. To accept responsibility would have far-reaching implications. One, it would encourage the arrival of millions of Palestinian refugees in the state of Israel, changing the demographics of the country in such a way as to effectively end the existence of the independent Jewish state. Two, it would be used as a basis for claims against Israel for compensation for loss of property and for 55 years of suffering. The American Jewish Committee takes a similar view of the Palestinian refugees, saying they are used to threaten Israel with destruction through exercise of the right of return, whereby the millions of refugees would inundate the state and erase its Jewish identity. But compare that language to the language of the AJC signed on to in the Boston statement against Trump. The approach to addressing these issues that was announced this past week is rooted in a rhetoric of fear and demonization and a policy that treats human beings around the world, including endangered refugees, many of whom are children who are suffering in devastating conditions, as an enforcement problem. The uncomfortable parallel between Trump's position on refugees and Israel's highlights the fact that both serve nationalist movements. It is no wonder that Trump and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are already best friends, with Netanyahu tweeting in favor of the immigration policy. And the news site Breitbart, that employed Steve Bannon and provided a platform for alt-right views that lifted Trump, was founded by a right-wing Zionist out of a devotion to Israel. For liberal and centrist Zionists, the overlap is more touchy. These groups have helped champion many progressive campaigns in the United States, leading to rights and freedoms we hold dear. They like to describe Israel as a Jewish democracy, and they have for some years worked against Benjamin Netanyahu. But the fine print on that Jewish democracy can prove to be a bit embarrassing, as it is in the case of refugees. Jeff Klein makes a similar observation in a letter to the Globe about the letter from 18 Jewish organizations. The Globe reports today that Jewish communal organizations are opposing President Trump's executive order on refugees and immigrants. That's a good thing. Unfortunately, these same groups are also promoting Massachusetts legislation, SD922 and HD779, that would punish critics of Israel who advocate pressure on that country as to live up to its human rights obligations, including on refugees. That was an article written by Philip Weiss in Mondo Weiss. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, an interview of journalist and author Max Blumenthal, conducted on Telesure by Abby Martin. Like many of our broadcasts, we found this on YouTube. And like most of Blumenthal's presentations, it is loaded with personal observations and analysis from the ground, from Israel and the West Bank, and in this case also Gaza, where he was during the last Israeli bombardment of that region in 2014. This interview on YouTube takes place as you witness video outtakes of Israel's subjugation of the Palestinian people. At times you will hear unidentified voices of people in those videos, including political leaders, even Netanyahu. But although as a radio audience listening to a YouTube presentation, you cannot see the images, the narration is easy to follow. So here is Abby Martin interviewing Max Blumenthal in a presentation called Max Blumenthal, Palestine's Rebellion, Israel's Fascism.
Today I'm sitting down with Max Blumenthal, investigative journalist and commentator on Israel and the struggle in Palestine. He's the author of the award-winning book Goliath and the recently published expose, The 51-Day War, where his on-the-ground reporting in Gaza in the aftermath of Operation Protective Edge documented the harrowing reality of Israel's war crimes. I wanted to find out what he discovered during his coverage of the war and how it relates to the current uprising in Palestine. Max, can you break down what's happening right now and what people are calling the Third Intifada?
It doesn't fit within the parameters of what we know an intifada to be, which is a nationwide uprising directed by political factions. What we're seeing is a completely disorganized rebellion by a generation of youth who've grown up after the Oslo Accords, which laid the basis for a two-state solution and the U.S.-led peace process was established. And they've grown up in that reality. It's a reality of separation, exclusion. They've witnessed the destruction of the Palestinian grassroots. All of the institutions of Palestinian life, especially in East Jerusalem, have been virtually eliminated. In the West Bank, they've been folded into the PA and the NGO infrastructure. And they see very little opportunity or hope. The occupation has deepened and tightened. They watched a 51-day assault on the Gaza Strip and felt helpless. They've seen the Palestinian de facto leadership in Ramallah, the Palestinian Authority led by Mahmoud Abbas, coordinate security with their occupier and sick their Palestinian forces on them, carrying out raids, for example, at Bir Zeit University. And so this generation has decided to act on its own. This has been building for a long time. But now that this generation has come of age, they're lashing out at their occupier. They're going out and demonstrating at the friction points of occupation. So, for example, at the checkpoint at Beit El in Al Bure outside Ramallah, there are regular demonstrations. They're throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails at heavily armed soldiers. Around Nablus, which is a site of settler terror, and especially in Hebron, where settlers, the most radical settlers in all of Israel-Palestine, are embedded in the old city and regularly terrorize and prey on Palestinians. They are carrying out attacks. There are knife attacks inside the Green Line, which is a symbolic act. And what they're doing is they're sending a message that as long as we're occupied, there's going to be a price. You're not going to be safe, and you won't be normal. As Netanyahu said recently, we are destined to live by the sword. But in Tel Aviv and Haifa and all of the cities inside Israel's interior, where most of the Jewish population lives, it will be like we're in Europe. Or as Ehud Barak, former Israeli prime minister and defense minister, said, we'll be a villa in the jungle. And when young Palestinians enter the villa with knives or with rocks or whatever they have, they are reminding Israelis, you're not a villa in the jungle. You're the jungle in our villa. You're in the Middle East, and you can't just put up a wall and pretend we're not here.
Why is the Al-Aqsa Mosque center to this political struggle?
First of all, Jerusalem has been separated from the West Bank and Ramallah under the thanks to the Oslo Accords. And the Oslo Accords provided the basis for a separation regime. The separation regime was manifested in the separation wall, which separates occupied East Jerusalem from the West Bank. The Israelis proceeded to destroy all of the key Palestinian institutions in East Jerusalem, like Orient House, which was supposed to be the future seat of a Palestinian government that would govern from the capital of East Jerusalem. That all moved to the other side of the wall, to Ramallah. And then every other institution proceeded to collapse. The only thing left was the Al-Aqsa Mosque as the symbol of Palestinian nationalism in Jerusalem. To me, it's much more about the Palestinian national struggle than about religion. But in Israeli society, you've seen in Jewish Israeli society a development where a religious nationalist class has risen in power. They're really reorienting society into a theocratic dominionist direction. And for them, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a symbol because it's the Temple Mount. There were supposedly Jewish temples there 1,300 years ago, and they aim to rebuild the temple as a symbol of the replacement of Israel as a state governed by civil law with a more theocratic, openly Jewish state, what I would call JSIL, or the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant. The Knesset and many of the ministers in Netanyahu's government are religious nationalists. The pressure on Al-Aqsa increases, and the pressure on Jerusalem increases, and the conflict, such as it is, takes on a religious dimension and begins to resemble a clash of civilizations instead of a struggle over rights and land. The Al-Aqsa Mosque has been almost completely encircled by Israeli settlers, and they've accomplished that through brute force, throwing Palestinians out of their home and replacing them with religious ultra-nationalists. They've built tunnels under Al-Aqsa Mosque, which actually have destabilized the infrastructural integrity of the old city of Jerusalem. And now they're beginning to prevent Palestinians from praying at Al-Aqsa for the first time, so that Jewish religious extremists can ascend and conduct their own kind of prayers. And so all of these disruptions have destabilized Jerusalem. Then you have 300,000 Palestinians in Jerusalem living under occupation with constant pressure from settlers. They're living among the most extreme elements of Israeli society who are armed. They themselves are not armed. The youth have been traumatized by this environment, and they're lashing out, and the friction point is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And remember, Al-Aqsa Mosque was where the Second Intifada began, when Ariel Sharon ascended with his surrounded by security forces, and it led to a complete bloodbath.
It has been another relentless day for the medics here as casualties continue to pour in. Tragically, many of those are children.
Naima is just 2.5 years old. She was caught in a missile attack from an F-16. She has a broken nose and a fractured skull. She hasn't spoken a word.
We were sleeping. Our house completely collapsed on us.
Doctors at the hospital here were unable to save Shahid.
Well, the siege on Gaza no doubt plays a role in the anger throughout all of Palestine. Max, you were on the ground and you outlined some harrowing details in your book about what you found. Outline the devastation that took place during last year's 51-day war.
I immediately, as soon as I entered Gaza, went to Shujaiya, which was the, you couldn't really call it a neighborhood. It's more like an entire city east of Gaza City that had been wiped off the map. By Israeli artillery and pretty much every mode of destruction available to the Israelis. Every house I went to there, they weren't really houses, they were ruins of homes, and speaking to elderly women and entire families about having their family members summarily executed in front of them, interviewing paramedics who found a woman, an 80-year-old woman in a chicken coop who had hid there for 8 days living off of chicken feed, pulling dead families, entire families out of homes and finding that they couldn't pull them out because their limbs would fall off and having to bring in bulldozers to bulldoze bodies into mass graves. Interviewing the Rajela family about fleeing tank fire and leaving their severely disabled daughter on the road in her wheelchair and then finding her in her wheelchair a week later riddled with bullets. These kind of stories were what I heard day after day. I mean, everywhere I went, I was walking through a real-life horror film, and this was the Palestinian experience in Gaza for 51 days. It was like a sequel to the movie Saw. How do you deal with that psychologically? That's the question we have to ask now, because the humanitarian situation is worse than it's ever been in history. The United Nations Relief Works Agency predicted that Gaza would be uninhabitable by 2020, and it's currently uninhabitable. People are trapped there. Most can't leave. And who are the Jewish Israelis, the 300,000 who participated in this operation? How do they think? Netanyahu was reelected in a surprise to a lot of Americans after Operation Protective Edge. You have to go into a very right-wing eliminationist mindset in order to justify what you did, and it's Netanyahu is able to cater to that. Just the amount of violence I witnessed was only the beginning of a nightmare that's continuing through the present. The Gaza Strip has 80% of the residents of the Gaza Strip, 72-80% are refugees. So it's a warehouse for surplus humans, and for the first time, you actually are seeing, for example, a wave of child suicides. I interviewed the father of Salem Shamali, who was killed on camera.
Guys, this one.
In the hand.
He was looking for his wounded cousin, and he was killed.
Yalla, 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 yalla. Shada la ilaha illallah. Allah.
It was reported on by international news, and the family. It really affected the family to find out, you know, our son was killed, and we found out because someone emailed us the video of his killing, and we only knew it was him because we recognized the sound of his screams. So Salem's father told me that his other sons and children are making amanat, which is a unique term that doesn't really have a clear English translation, but it means like their last dying wishes. So the violence, of course, is on, you know, it's a physical violence, but there's a psychological component to it. The Israelis threatened to bomb the main hospital, the Al-Najjar hospital in Rafah, and so everyone had to pour out of the hospital, wounded people, people missing limbs, and the entire medical staff, and the only place left was the Kuwaiti hospital, which is actually a 20-bed OBGYN and geriatric clinic in the center of town that's completely unequipped for this kind of disaster. And the doctor I met there, Samir Holmes, told me that he was treating amputees on the floor, that his own medical staff was coming in dead, and that the carnage got so bad that he had to order ice cream coolers from local shops to store the corpses of infants. And this image that is widely available of four infants in white death shrouds in an ice cream cooler, I think is iconic. It's the image that distills the entire sensibility of Israeli society at this point and how little value they place on Palestinian life.
And as Israeli forces were using the Hannibal directive and kind of indiscriminately shooting even on their captured soldiers, Al-Qassam Brigade was changing its tactics over the last couple of years. We saw it act pretty differently during the 51-day war. Talk about what happened there.
The tactics of Al-Qassam as a guerrilla force in face-to-face confrontations with Israeli soldiers was untested. And the Israeli military underestimated their capacity. Through the tunnel network in the south of Gaza, the Al-Qassam Brigades and Hamas had been able to import some heavy weaponry, like the kind of weapons that Hezbollah in southern Lebanon had. I mean, Cornet anti-tank missiles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, lots of AK-47s, and some heavier machine guns that could be carried. But more importantly, the Al-Qassam Brigades imported the tactics of Hezbollah. They may have received some Syrian training or indirect Syrian training through Hezbollah. And this proved very effective when the Israeli military invaded in July the neighborhood of Shujaiya. You saw basically local teams of fighters situate themselves in tunnels in and around Shujaiya and then wait to ambush Israeli soldiers who had initially entered in very lightly armored vehicles, which were supplied by the U.S. military as surplus and were left over from the Vietnam era. And some Qassam sapper teams were able to destroy these vehicles by simply planting charges on them by hand, explosive charges by hand, displaying a lot of bravado. But the most important tactic, I think, that was put on display in Shujaiya was the willingness to engage Israeli troops at less than 15 meters away for prolonged periods of time. During Casled in 2008-2009, Al-Qassam would stage hit-and-run attacks, and they learned from Hezbollah that you don't hit and run, you stay in the fight, because that neutralizes the two strengths that Israel has over every other military in the Middle East: air power and artillery power. If you have soldiers engaged in face-to-face fighting, you can't provide air support or artillery support because you'll kill them. The Israeli military found it, this is the Golani Brigade, its most elite special forces, who have very little experience, actually, in real fighting, really motivated, well-armed forces. I mean, they're more used to beating up on farmers and stone-throwing kids in the West Bank. They found themselves losing their lives at an alarming rate. Injuries were coming in by the dozens. And I think it was the night of July 14th. I might be getting the date wrong. They decided to retreat and carry out one of the most cowardly military maneuvers in modern military history. Retreat in armored personnel carriers as fast as they could to the border of Israel and Gaza, and then unload with what amounted to half of the artillery pieces in the Israeli military and blanket the entire area with 120 and 155 millimeter howitzers. And that's what resulted in the destruction of Shujaiya, was actually the defeat, or the moral defeat, of the Israeli military. The most famous operation was at Nahal Oz. This was later on in July. A team of Al-Qassam fighters with GoPro cameras attached to their helmets attacked an Israeli military base. The goal was to capture soldiers, I think, which would have been a game changer, would have given them a lot of leverage in negotiations, might have even ended the war. But they managed to kill almost every soldier they encountered. They lost only one member of their team and made it back into the tunnel with one of the soldiers' rifles, which was upheld as a trophy at the end of the war. This operation demonstrated, or had two effects. One was it demonstrated that the Al-Qassam brigades aren't interested in attacking civilians because Nahal Oz is also, the base is part of a kibbutz. I mean, they could have gone and killed civilians, but they chose to engage soldiers. And Al-Qassam General Commander Mohammed Deif stated clearly that we're attacking soldiers while you bring the roofs down on the heads of our civilians. And the second effect it had was securing almost unanimous support in Palestinian society, including among, you know, Fatawi, you know, Fatah supporting people in Ramallah for the concept of armed resistance. You're used to seeing your relatives and your friends and even experiencing yourself humiliation at the hands of Israeli soldiers, especially if you live in Jerusalem or one of the areas where settlers are. And for the first time, you see young Palestinian guys dressed up like commandos, giving the Israeli military a bloody nose and taking the fight to the enemy. I mean, that had a strong psychological impact in Palestinian society. And so now there's a lot of criticism of Hamas, dissent against Hamas in the Gaza Strip. But I don't know anyone who would question the importance of maintaining a kind of guerrilla force that's highly militarized and is there to fight the Israeli military.
The Israeli parliament has approved a law that imposes stiff penalties on people convicted of throwing rocks at moving vehicles. Under the law, stone throwers could face 10 years in prison and up to 20 years if it is determined that they intended to seriously harm the occupants in a vehicle. The lawmaker who sponsored the legislation said that one-third of arrests in Jerusalem are connected to stone throwing.
So the government's going to great lengths to crush resistance there. The latest measure is the 20-year prison sentence for anyone throwing a stone. Max, talk about the significance of stones in Palestine and why you think this law was passed.
In this case, this law was passed by the Israeli parliament, a very extreme law, and members of the Labor Party and the opposition supported it. It wasn't just right-wingers who were determined to throw young people in jail for almost their entire adult life for throwing a stone. It shows how threatened Israeli society is by the smallest, most minuscule iterations of Palestinian resistance, even symbolic resistance like stones. And now it's become a symbol of resistance and telling Israelis that they're not welcome. You know, why are you throwing rocks at a soldier who's wearing a Kevlar vest and is protected against, you know, 7.62 millimeter live rounds? The Israelis are responding now with unprecedented measures. I went to the hospital in Ramallah in July and interviewed a doctor who told me that he was treating dozens of gunshot wounds to the legs, and that Israel had a shoot to cripple policy. And he provided me with documentation, which pretty much showed that soldiers were cracking down on demonstrations with live fire to the legs. Not only that, but some of the bullets were what Palestinians call ton-ton bullets or dum-dum bullets, which are expanding rounds. So they'll bounce around inside your limbs and expand and really cripple you for life. The Israeli this bill to jail stone throwers for 20 years is complements another measure put into place by the Israeli military and police, which allows even members of the Israeli police to shoot demonstrators with 22 caliber rounds from Ruger rifles. The 22 caliber rounds are less likely to kill. They're more likely to cripple. They shatter bones. They often bounce around inside your body. This is standard practice now. standard practice to shoot demonstrators with live weapons.
The Palestinians, unfortunately, instead of building a Gaza Strip as the Singapore of the Middle East, they choose the terror path.
They want to pile up as many civilian dead as they can, because somebody said they use, I mean, it's gruesome, they use telegenically dead Palestinians for their cause. They want the more dead, the better.
In the letter, and I'll read it to you, you say the formerly populated areas will be shelled in Gaza with maximum firepower. The entire civilian and military infrastructure of Hamas will be destroyed entirely. And then you say those who insist on staying will be required to publicly sign a declaration of loyalty to Israel.
People might be surprised to learn that Netanyahu is actually not the most right-wing in Israeli government, that it's actually just gotten more and more right-wing over the last decade.
Benjamin Netanyahu, I've been saying for the last 2 years, exists at the hollow center of Israeli politics. You know, I talked about the generation of Palestinian youth, the post-Oslo generation, and how they've developed. But within Israeli society, there's been a parallel development with the post-Oslo generation that's extremely radical, sees no hope for, you know, a two-state solution or a peace process. Their approach to the Palestinians is that there's no partner for peace and that they only understand force. This is a generation that's adopted a very strongly Jewish identity and a belligerent Jewish identity, as opposed to the identity of Israel's founding generation, which was based around a concept of Israeli nationalism, which was racist, but which allowed for some place for Palestinians or Arabs. The kind of sensibility and identity this generation has adopted leaves no place for anyone who's a non-Jew. And this generation is embodied by the current justice minister, Ayelet Shaked. That bill we talked about to punish stone throwers for 20 years, that was her baby. She ushered it through the Knesset. She's young. I think she's, you know, she's our age. She's very telegenic. She's very popular in Israeli society. She's not a settler. She comes from a core Israeli city. In many ways, she's kind of a carpetbagger. And she is genocidal in her approach to Palestinians. In fact, she called for genocide during Operation Protective Edge, for exterminating Palestinian mothers to prevent them from giving birth to little snakes. She's in charge of the Justice Ministry. And you look at the direction of Israeli society. You just look at the polls from Israeli Democracy Institute that show that a majority of youth state their refusal to sit in a classroom with an Arab or a non-Jew, that a majority of youth favor a kind of one-state apartheid solution. In 2011, in this poll, a plurality of Israelis stated their support for placing Arab citizens of the State of Israel in internment camps during wartime. Three-quarters of Israelis in a recent poll reported by the Times of Israel, three-quarters of religious nationalist Israelis declared their support for the full ethnic cleansing of Palestinian citizens of Israel, the 20% of Israel who are Palestinian citizens, and 80% said that they boycott Arab businesses. So you look at the direction of Israeli society and you have to conclude that there's no hope for change from within, that those of us on the outside who want to see a different outcome than perpetual conflict can't work from inside Israeli society. We don't have a place for convincing people. There has to be pressure from the outside. And the pressure has to start here, because it's Washington and the U.S. government that has funded radicalization in Israel. They've paid for this whole project, because every time Israel builds settlements, every time they give money to the settlers, every time the education ministry brings kids to Hebron to see the settlements, every time that they decide to teach kindergartners about the Holocaust and scare kindergartners into an authoritarian mindset, and every time they assault Gaza and get as much time as they want, the U.S. is there to pay for the whole project and to rearm them. And so they're rewarding radicalism in Jewish Israeli society, and that's really ultimately why this trend is continuing.
That was an interview with journalist and author Max Blumenthal, conducted by Abby Martin on Telesure. The YouTube video from which the interview was extracted ended with a video of an Israeli military tank rolling into the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem. Over a loudspeaker system, an Israeli soldier shouts the following, which is translated from the Arabic. People of Aida camp, we are the occupational army. You throw stones and we will hit you with gas until you die. The children, the youth, the old people, you will die. We won't leave any of you alive. We have arrested one of you. He is with us now. We took him from his home, and we will slaughter and kill him while you watch if you keep throwing stones. Go home, or we will gas you until you die. Your children, your families, everyone, we will kill you. Listen to me. All of you go home. It's better for you. The video ends with the sound of a rifle shot. Just think for a minute what it would be like for your children, our children, to hear such threats almost daily from a heavily armed military vehicle rolling down our streets. It is this constant threat of bodily injury and family disruption which has led to generations of traumatized children. The occupation continues to extract a terrible price on the youth and families of Palestine. Since the election of Donald Trump, increasingly in the United States, we are hearing the word resist. The outpouring of demonstrators on our streets, malls, airports, and city centers is staggering. Resistance to what really constitutes attacks on women, immigrants, Muslims, gays, and the transgendered, and in fact, a host of values we thought were sacrosanct in this country. We can more easily relate to Palestine because, in a very real sense, we are coming under occupation of what seems like a foreign power that has taken over our country. Not as dramatically as in Palestine, to be sure, and I do not want to labor this, but I am struck by the fact that we are talking about setting up a resistance movement in the United States of America. And so I was struck by a piece written by Nadia Aliyah, a Palestinian journalist, and we conclude our broadcast this morning with her words. Nadia Aliyah writes, U.S. President Donald Trump's first week in office far exceeded our worst fears. Nevertheless, as the orders came in, millions of Americans were ready. When, barely a week in office, Trump issued his Muslim ban, cities and smaller towns across the nation erupted again in rallies and marches. One of the chants heard at the protest was, From Mexico to Palestine, all walls will fall. It is a chant that indicates an awareness of our connected struggle. And just as Gaza to Ferguson has entered and taken hold of American consciousness, expanding our understanding of solidarity and intersectionality, so no ban, no wall, and all walls will fall, must and will become a part of American resistance. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.